The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
The following is brought to you in part by MFC Studios. The views and opinions of the show's hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect those of the owners, management, or staff of WGBB. And now, it came from the radio.
Hello and welcome once again to A Game Fun Radio. This is your host, Mark Torres, speaking. With me in the studio, I have myself, along with Brian the Engineer, and Kara the ex-intern, who is going to have a new name because she just keeps on showing up for some reason.
And you're the one who keeps calling her the ex-intern.
Well, she was an intern. And
just
she's
call
no
her
longer.
Kara, that's all.
But she needs a name.
She's got a name.
But
you mean a title?
Yes, she needs a title. Yes, she needs a title.
Let her choose her own title.
What do you want your title to be, Kara?
Kara the Great One.
Kara the Great One.
See?
Kara the Great One. The ex-Great One.
Really, Mike?
How is she the ex-Great One?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how she's the Great One.
Listen, it's an ego problem.
It's an ego thing.
Well, because she was the Great One. Now she no longer is.
How is she no longer the Great One?
Because
she
was
the title of the Great One.
Because that's her title. So if she was no longer the title of the intern, she is now the title of the Great One. And she was an ex-intern, so then she became the ex-Great One.
How does she become the... Never mind. I mean, your logic is flawed. She chooses her own title, right? You can't tell her she's an ex-whatever she just chose. That makes no sense.
Well, because she's replacing the intern with the Great One.
Move on. Continue with the introduction.
And our very own Charlie Saladino is having car trouble. So hopefully he's dealing with our awesome sponsors, which I'll get to in just a few seconds. So if anybody's having any trouble listening to us on the air, you can go online, www.am1240wgbb.com. Listen to us on the live audio streaming.
By the way, my name is Hassan Godwin. I am at home right now.
Hassan Godwin is in a purgatory.
Homatory. I'm a third host, but I wasn't introduced just now. But that's
no.
Okay.
Oh, you're on quarantine because you got that Ebola virus.
Yeah,
in homatory.
That's really what we want to wish on people.
I didn't
Why does anybody happen to have a story? I'm just at home. I'm calling in from home.
That's
God's sake.
That's not entertaining.
No. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
That was
Belmore. Let's get to Belmore.
Also on the WGBB website, you can see us live on the web camera, unless you have that spy stuff, and you can see Hassan.
In Ebola pest tent. Okay,
yes,
that's fine.
So yes, we're just going to take it away with the news.
No, get to Belmore.
Well, yes, the news is brought to you in part by the Rat Bastards at Belmore Towing, located in
Which
Belmore.
Probably
York.
Charlie is listening to you right now.
Yes,
while they're towing him
because they're our sponsors. So he would go to the Rat Bastards at Belmore Towing to handle all his all his towing needs, which would consist of paying $50 for a $7 lug nut, amongst other things.
Amongst many other things,
many
nefarious and dirty and vile things,
but legal. But legal, you gotta add that point.
But legal.
Yes, it is legal, so therefore.
It is all legal.
Yes.
It's just vile and despicable.
Right, but legal, so we're okay. So we're covered.
It's like kicking a dog.
Yes.
It's legal, but it's despicable.
I don't think kicking a dog is legal.
You can kick a dog.
Don't tell people to go kick a dog.
You can kick a dog. You could claim that dog tried to bite you and you kicked it.
Oh, so that's self defense.
Kill a dog. That's
right.
Illegal.
Okay.
Kick a dog.
Okay. So.
And it's vile.
From the desk of Hassan Godwin, kicking a dog is
not
illegal.
That Hassan Godwin condones kicking
right.
dogs. I'm
just
saying it's not illegal.
Item. Yes, it's just a news item.
Okay.
And also the news and the show is brought to you by the new movie that's coming out soon to theaters, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Monkey Killer. I'm gonna make that into a movie. We're gonna make posters and everything. It's gonna be the greatest thing ever. Even if it's like a 30-second movie, it's just going to have... You know what was funny?
Mark, can I star in this movie?
Yes, you can star in the movie.
Okay, because I saw Dawn of the Apes not too long ago, and it got me inspired to be in Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. Abraham Lincoln, Monkey
Vampire
Killer.
You've got to get an ape suit and a top hat, and basically we're ready to go at that point.
I want a monocle and a mustache, too.
It's no problem.
It's already done. That's a done deal.
It's funny how you mentioned this. Just yesterday, I've mentioned many times, I work at a movie theater, and this little kid, no more than 4 or 5 years old, walks up to me, and he says, "Hey, you look like Abraham Lincoln." I kid you not. So I'm like, wow, I had no idea.
So you need to shave. That's what he was telling you.
What is this, the 1800s? Shave that beard.
So we're going to take away with the sad news first. Always with the sad news. Sky McColl Bartusiak, I hope that I pronounced that correctly, which I probably didn't, known for playing the youngest daughter of Mel Gibson's character in the 2000 film The Patriot, passed away this month. Although she passed away in her sleep, a cause of death is unknown. According to her mother, she had been suffering from epileptic seizures in the last few days. As a child actor, she appeared in such films as Cedar House Rules and Don't Say a Word with Michael Douglas. And recently, she had roles on 24, Lost, House MD, and CSI. She was only 21.
Wow. Okay, that's sad.
Yeah, that's...
That's sad.
Yeah.
And she was just having epileptic seizures for the last few days. Not that she suffered...
Right.
Genuinely or generally from epilepsy.
Correct. So they don't even know what was the problem or the reason. It's just she had epileptic seizures and then finally she died in her sleep.
Wow.
At the age of 21.
I think she was the daughter in The Patriot.
The youngest daughter.
Yeah, the one that couldn't speak.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
So now you have an idea.
That's too bad.
Yeah. So moving on, we're going to go on to some happy news now. So...
I guess that's a decent segue.
Well, I'm waiting for the cue.
It wasn't actually a segue.
This is what I said. I said, let's see how this works. And Brian says, this will work out great.
Oh, there's my guy to read.
It's more than time!
Roberto Orchi. Well,
Hold on. First of all, Brian, you're going to have to be way quicker. You have to catch his segues. They're very subtle. So we're going to do that, which is awesome, by the way. It's fantastic, by the way.
Shall we try that again?
Yes, let's try that again. So moving on to the news.
It's more than time!
Writer Roberto Orci has been brought in as executive producer on the new Power Rangers movie. He'll be joining writers Ashley Miller and Zach Steins, who most recently wrote X-Men First Class. Roberto says they have 600 pages of research they have been doing on their stuff. We've read through the synopsis of everything they did, and we are actually taking into quite a bit of canon in a real way. We're not just leaving it behind in a reboot. Ham Saban cares very much about that. This is something that he created. I had to go to his house personally and tell him, listen, I'm your man. Miller and Stiles, these are your guys. I promise I won't ruin your franchise. To which he replied, Power Rangers is very important to me because kids around the world know what the Power Rangers are. You just can't come in here and walk all over it. I told Roberto it better be consistent with what I've been doing, and he said, yes, sir. As for the former cast members of the movie, Roberto says, of course, that's something we want to rely on Saban Group to tell us. They have a lot of internal knowledge of their franchise, and we're just learning it now. We've seen it only as fans, and they actually know it inside and out, so I'd love to see what the fans want to see.
Over, Mark. Are you upset? I'm very sorry for you.
He promises that it's not going to ruin the franchise.
It's Roberto Orci.
I know,
hello,
but he...
Hello, the guy who... He took a poop all over Star Trek for 2 movies, okay? And then told the Star Trek fans to F off when they had the nerve to not like the awesomeness that was his interpretation of a 50-year, like, you know, an over 30-year, it's all, yeah, 50. It's
yeah,
50-year 50 franchise.
Yeah.
A 50-year-old franchise.
Right.
He poops on it.
Yes.
Okay? And then they come and say, hey, why'd you poop on this? And he says, F you, I'll poop on it again if I have to. He's in charge of Power Rangers.
He's the executive producer, but he's not writing it. So I, you know,
it doesn't matter. His work ethic speaks for itself.
And
congratulations.
He's only one half of the duo. Remember, it was him and the other guy. So
yeah, Kurtzman, who jumped ship, who didn't tell the fans to f off, who jumped ship a long time ago because probably Orchy has been, and Orchy and Kurtzman were in charge of the Transformers nightmare.
Yes,
that was Transformers 2.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. However, the Hawaii 5-0 that they did together was pretty good.
I never saw a Hawaii 5-0, strictly because they did it together, and I wouldn't do that to myself. I'll take your word for it that it was good.
So
I'm telling you, Power Rangers is done. It's done. Pack it. Yo, you know what you need to do? Gather up all your paraphernalia, all your expensive Power Rangers paraphernalia that you...
Actually, I don't have anything except the...
Don't ruin the image.
Okay. All right.
Okay? You got tons of it. Ready?
Okay, yes.
Ready? Listen
yes.
to me.
All right.
Pack it up that you've amassed for the last 20 years. Sell it. Sell it now like stock. Okay? It's not going to be worth crap when the new movie comes out. Is it a new movie or is he executive producing a new television show?
Well, the series is still on the air. They're making a new movie.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Because it's Morphin Time.
Yeah, because it's Morphin Time. That's right.
Okay.
Exactly.
What other news do you have?
All righty. So let's see.
Pack that stuff up, man. It's over.
Last week, Weird Al Yankovic's Mandatory Fun became the first comedy album in more than 50 years to reach number one on the Billboard Top 200.
Good for Weird Al.
Surpassing Alan Sherman's My Son the Nut, which held on to the top position for 8 weeks in 1963.
Wow.
Mandatory Fun, which sold 104,000 copies last week, is the first comedy album in history to debut at number one. Yankovic is also the first comedy artist to amass 3 top 10 albums since Cheech and Chong, which had 3 top albums in a row from 1972 to 1974.
Weird Al is a god.
And just
amazing. He's amazing. Did you know that this is a cute little trivia story? It took the guys from, and I don't know names, so I apologize for this being kind of skewed, like urban legend. The lead singer of Devo heard Weird Al's parody of Whip It. Okay?
Right.
And Weird Al just kind of slapped that together and threw it out because it came out roughly a couple of months after Whip It came out.
Right.
So, you know, to capitalize off the thing. And the guy's like, well, we spent almost 20 years trying to come up with a sound for Devo. And this guy just imitates it in a couple of months, you know? And they were dismayed by it. I think that was around the same time as Dare to Be Stupid and some of the other stuff
right.
that he has done that is very popular came out. So the man is absolutely a genius. No argument.
I remember.
No argument that he deserves that number one spot.
I remember the Amish Paradise.
Thing. I remember that, Eat It.
That Coolio had said that he didn't want him to make a parody, which is not legal. It's not illegal to do. You know, you can make a parody of anything you want. But Weird Al always goes out and asks the artist if he can. And they always say yes, and he actually said no, but there was some confusion, and he thought they said yes, so that's how Amish Paradise came to be. And interviewed, Cleo was like, he better watch out for me, and as a response, Weird Al said, I'm going to watch out for him.
Genius. The man's a genius. Eat It was a genius.
Yeah.
Another One Rides the Bus. When I was a child, that was my favorite album. Another One Rides the Bus. And I loved Another One Bites the Dust. So
yeah, and
that
certain
just goes to tell you.
And certain songs you actually remember the parody more than the real song.
Yeah, I could sing you Another One Rides the Bus right now. Trust me, but I won't. But he deserves a spot.
So just 4 other comedy artists have landed 3 top 10 albums. Shelley Berman from 1959 and 1960, Bob Newhart from 1960-1961, Alan Sherman, the aforementioned, from 1962 to 1963, and Bill Cosby from 1966 to 1968. So
nobody even hit the 70s. Since from the, like, safely said, from the 70s all the way up to the 2001s.
50 years. It's,
okay, the 2010s. No one has been able to do what Weird Al has done just now.
Yeah, so
that's fantastic.
Yeah, so and this was his quote unquote swan song as albums go.
Oh, this is his last album?
His last album, because his contract ended with the company that he's with, so he decided he's gonna do, you know, YouTube stuff and other avenues of music, but he's not only gonna do a 12, you know, track album.
They're gonna renew that contract. If his album debuted at number one, selling 100-something thousand copies in the first week that it was out.
Yeah.
He's getting a renewed contract. He might not want it.
But he's getting one?
Huh?
He might not want it.
He might not want it. He might not take it, but it's not like they're going to not renew his contract.
Right.
Trust me. There's no way that's going to happen.
So let's see. Speaking of renewal, let's see. Oh, okay, we'll do this one. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are teaming up with the Ghostbusters in a new comic book miniseries crossover. Executive says... When a new invention goes haywire, the Turtles are sent to a whole new type of New York City, one with a lot more ghosts and Ghostbusters. The two teens will have to learn to get along.
So the Ghostbusters and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles don't automatically exist in the same New York?
No.
That's BS. I've absolutely seen both Ghostbusters and Ninja Turtles in my travels in New York City while going back and forth to work. So... I know for a fact they already exist in New York City.
Well, that's the third universe.
We're in the third. Okay, fair enough.
The two teens have to learn to get along quickly because a new foe from the Turtles' past has followed them and aims to conquer New York City. These two legendary heroes would join forces to save New York City from a world that is paranormal and a monstrous when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cross paths with their Ghostbusters, with both franchises celebrating their 30-year anniversaries. It's never been a better time to team up with Proton Packs and Ninjutsu.
Quit saying 30 years.
It's, yeah.
It's, no. 1984 Ghostbusters. My goodness.
Yeah.
All right,
so finally, this is a big one. This last bit of news, so I'm going to take up a little extra time with it. As everybody knows, Comic-Con was last weekend, San Diego Comic-Con, the quote-unquote biggest, although not by attendance, comic book convention in the entire United States, and probably
really?
World.
Not by attendance?
Well, the New York Comic-Con, by attendance, has more people than the San Diego, but San Diego is bigger.
Surpassed San Diego.
Yeah, okay. New York Comic-Con has surpassed by numbers.
Wow.
But, of course, they don't have Hollywood behind them, and it's not a city that embraces the whole thing, so you still get the bigger experience
at
San Diego.
Fair enough.
So, you know, when that happens, you know, there's tons of news items coming out about the secret stuff leaked and the footage and all the stuff they've been showing, the Wonder Woman, the Batman stuff. All this stuff has been coming out, but there's a little story that was kind of overlooked only by like the hardcore comic book fans that are out there, and I wanted to bring this to the attention. There was an open letter posted to the San Diego Comic-Con, which in part reads, I am turning 60 years old next March. I mentioned that major turning point in my life only because the last time I did not attend a San Diego Comic-Con, I was 17 years old, still in high school. Since I graduated, for all 42 years of my adult life, I have committed the heart of each of my summers to my personal obsession with experiencing the joys of the San Diego Comic-Con. I even passed this personal passion on to my part of my four daughters, all of whom are spent their entire childhoods delightedly roaming the halls of various incarnations of this great comics convention. Sadly, that entire blessed reality may need to end after this year's show closes tomorrow evening. I have not yet found the courage to reach my final decision, but my best estimate is that at our current rate of sales, we will suffer a loss of $10,000 at this year's show. As much as I like being part of this wonderful gathering, I simply do not have the money to be able to pay the $10,000 out of my own pocket for the privilege of providing fans here with the comic books. After 42 consecutive years in a row, it may finally at long last be time for me to bid San Diego goodbye forever. The letter goes on to say how lack of sales are due to mostly the publishers selling exclusive variants from their own booths. So this is comic book. Obviously, a comic book's a seller. He goes to the convention, has his own books. You know, the retailers.
It cost him $10,000 to get
a loss of $10,000.
I know, but I mean, is he saying?
So I'm sure
saying that he can't meet that price because he hasn't because his sales have not been up, or it, and in other words, is that how much San Diego charges for dealers to be on the show floor?
I'm thinking it's more personally. For a booth his size, I'm sure it's more.
Because it's more than $10,000.
Yeah, because it's a...
And
you know,
he's losing out. His basic attitude, or is not his contention, basically, is that he's losing out on sales because most of the, like, Marvel, DC, whatever, whoever, the major ones who have a booth there are selling their own variants of their own books.
Right, that are only available...
To drum up attention and to get, you know, basically the equivalent of butts in the seats, or, you know... Feet in the aisle, I guess.
Right.
Of aisle traffic to their booth, and they're stealing it away from the honest, you know, hardworking dealers who are selling regular comic books and you know, hawking their books and their wares in a normal fashion.
Right.
That with the okay.
It closes with. So where does this leave us? As much as I hate to admit this, it now seems obvious to me that we finally have to end a lifetime of exhibiting at San Diego and instead seek out relatively popular comic conventions in other cities, especially conventions where our publisher friends choose not to exhibit. Doesn't that, though, just drip with irony? Comic publishers have evolved to become toxic to their own retailers. Who would have ever thought that would happen? Even with all my many years of experience, I simply cannot believe that our world has now been so perverted by the mania for exclusive variants that comic retailers can now only survive in the absence of the very publishers we support. No matter how you look at it, this is a profoundly sad day. The letter is signed by Chuck Runzanski, president of Mile High Comics. For anybody who knows anything about any comic book convention, Mile High Comics has been around for as long as I can remember,
yeah.
And it was at every single convention I've ever been at. And they
yes,
have a huge library inventory of stock. And they're always there, every place. I remember their ads in old 80s comics. You know, they've been around forever. So a big name as Mile High Comics is not going to be at the biggest comic book convention in the entire United States.
There are huge complaints about the New York Comic Con and how they're terrible shows for the retailers because they don't sell anything. Nobody comes to buy anything. Now, I know I watched after a booth in New York for a particular dealer or, you know, exhibitor. Dealer,
right.
Who I won't name. And all night, all afternoon long, regardless of how much paraphernalia was on the, you know, was on the counter with price tags and stuff like that, people would come to me and say, "What's free?
Right.
What can I have that's free?" And that, I mean, more so, I was supposed to be there to help sell some stuff and to watch after the cash box and to make change. I didn't make one sale, and it's not for lack of trying. It wasn't because I just sat there like a lump. It was literally no one wants to buy anything. No one's buying anything. So on top of that, you've got the, you know, you've got these super companies, these, you know, super retailers, or the super exhibitors, with these gigantic, you know, $50,000 booths, with music coming out of it, and you know, booth girls, and you know, actual artists who are, you know, signing stuff or exhibiting there or doing interviews and stuff like that, and they're selling books. Kids come in, they see this gigantic show. They can't possibly get around the whole show, and they don't have the money to linger all day and spend money everywhere they go. They're going to gravitate to the shiniest booth that sells the, you know, that sells the most exclusive thing that they think that they, you know, they can get more bang for their buck from. And yeah, that leaves everybody else out of it. But it's called ever diminishing returns. If everybody has to be big in order to get, you know, aisle traffic, everybody has to sell in order to get aisle traffic.
Right.
Everybody has to be more spectacular than the last guy. Then the guy with the most money is always going to be the one who wins. It's just the way it happens. And I don't say that as, well, it's, you know, Mile High Comics has to just, you know, deal with it. I completely agree. It's tragic. I completely agree that it's going in a bad direction. But because it's all corporate. The entire convention scene is a corporate monster now. And we still have fun. We can still go. We can still cosplay. But we're still consumers. We're not people who have kind of thrown in to this, you know, staked our fortune on this entity. Not yet.
Yeah.
You know? So we don't suffer the loss. We don't see the loss as prominently as they do. And as we can't foretell it as well as they can, because we don't see the changes, really. We just see the place getting bigger, and more people are there, and it's getting crowded, it's hard to get around. So this must be a huge success, so this will definitely be around for, you know, a couple of decades. And that's all we know. But I've had more than one complaint from the New York comic. I've had these people like, I don't know if I can keep doing this. It's expensive to have a booth here. We're not selling anything. Nobody wants to buy anything. Nobody came here to buy, to be part of the theme. You know, people just want the most exclusive deal for the least amount of money they can get so that they can say that they came here.
Yeah. But on the flip side, I can say without a doubt that the experiment that the New York Comic Con did do for that the summer show, people did have sales because it was strictly for comics. There was no flashy, you know, big giant booths. It was comics and the little guys, and they had a couple of big booths, but it wasn't anything nowhere near compared to, as I've been to San Diego and I've been to, you know, New York Comic Con, we've been to tons of shows, the Wizard shows, the Big Apple cons. There was no giant flashy stuff, so we were able to focus more on all the comics. And I've spoken to them at that point, so I guess they're trying to do something to counteract it, but the giant show in October is going to be what it is, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really sad that a guy, 42 years doing this, and he had a loss of $10,000. That blows my mind.
That's staggering.
You know,
although he had a good run for 42 years, not a lot of stuff.
But still,
I don't mean to diminish it. I'm not diminishing it. I mean, but that's a good run. But eventually, if you're going to do something for over 40 years, things are going to be different.
Yes.
From the time you start to the time you finish it. You might not be ready for the change.
Right.
As all of us have discovered.
Right.
That sometimes we're just not up to the change. But 42 years, you got a good 42 years out of it. It's not a consolation prize. It's not like you should take your loss and smile.
Right.
$10,000 is $10,000, okay?
Yes.
That's a lot of money.
Okay.
But still, you know, it's 42 years. You got a solid run.
Right. So we are ready for our break. We'll be right back with a Came From the Radio.
Hi, this is Amory. You've heard my voice open and close the show. Now we want to hear your voice. If you have a business or product, you can record a commercial here. We offer 30 and 60 second spots. For more information, contact Mark at mfc_studios@hotmail.com. And now, here's some music.
Just too white and nerdy. Can't you see I'm white and nerdy? Look at me, I'm white and nerdy. I wanna roll with the gangsters. They're so far, they all think I'm too white and nerdy. Think I'm just too white and nerdy. Think I'm just too white and nerdy. I'm just too white and nerdy. Really, really white and nerdy.
First in my class, they're at MIT. Got skills, I'm a champion of D&D. MC Escher, that's my favorite MC. Keep your 40 out, just have an Earl Grey tea. My rims never spin, to the contrary, you'll find that they're quite stationary. All of my action figures are cherry. Stephen Hawking's in my library. My MySpace page's all totally pimped out. Got people begging for my top 8 spaces. Yo, I know pie to 1,000 places. Ain't got no grills, but I still wear braces. I order all of my sandwiches with mayonnaise. I'm a whiz, a minesweeper, I can play for days. Once you see my sweet moves, you're gonna stay amazed. My fingers moving so fast, I'll set the place ablaze. There's no killer app I haven't run. At Pascal, well, I'm number one. Do vector calculus just for fun. I ain't got a gap, but I got a soldering gun. Happy Days is my favorite theme song. I could sure kick your butt in a game of ping pong. I'll ace any trivia quiz you bring on. I'm fluent in JavaScript as well as Klingon. Here's the part I sing on.
You see me roll on my Segway.
I know in my heart they think I'm white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
Can't you see I'm white and nerdy?
Look at me, I'm white and nerdy.
I like to roll with the gangsters, although it's apparent I'm too white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
I'm just too white and nerdy.
How'd I get so white and nerdy?
Been browsing, inspecting X-Men comics, you know I collect them. The pens in my pocket, I must protect them. My ergonomic keyboard never leaves me bored. Shopping online for deals on some writable media. I edit Wikipedia. I memorize Holy Grail really well. I can recite it right now and have you ROTFLOL. I got a business doing websites. While friends need some code, who do they call? I do HTML for them all. Even made a homepage for my doll. Yo, I got myself a fanny pack. They were having a sale down at the Gap. Spend my nights with a roll of bubble wrap. Pop, pop, hope no one sees me getting freaky.
I'm nerdy and the extreme and whiter than sour cream.
I was in AV club and glee club and even the chess team. Only question I ever thought was hard. What do I like, Kirk, or do I like Picard?
Spend every weekend at the Renaissance Fair. Got my name on my underwear.
They see me strolling, they laughing, and rolling their eyes cause I'm so white and nerdy.
Just because I'm white and nerdy.
Just because I'm white and nerdy.
All because I'm white and nerdy.
Holy cow, I'm white and nerdy.
I wanna bowl with the gangsters, but oh well, it's obvious I'm white.
Just too white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
I'm just too white and nerdy.
Look at me, I'm white and nerdy.
Wow, that was hot. Now, back to our show.
And welcome back to It Came From the Radio. This is your host, Mark Torres, speaking along with Hassan Godwin in Homotori, and Brian the engineer, and Kara the ex-great one. That was a Yankovics, white and nerdy, as we were just talking about Weird Yankovics. That was very nicely done, guys. And on the phone this week, we have a special guest on the phone, Vera Green Tea from Green Tea Publications, Productions, right? Publications or Productions?
Publishing.
I knew it was a P, and that was pretty much all I had. So, Vera, we met at the New York Comic Con. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us about your experiences at that New York Comic Con?
Well, I'm a writer of comic books, and, well, what I do is basically just write things, and I throw them at the internet. I do lots of fantasy, horror type of stuff. My most popular series is Recipes for the Dead, and then I also have a series called Nanette of the Forgotten Spirits, and Papa is a short story collection. And, yes, that's who I am. And I had an amazing experience at Special Edition. It was actually probably my inaugural kind of, like, experience, because I haven't actually been to a, like, I've been to a very small Comic-Con before that as an exhibitor. This was my second time, but my first time at such a large, expensive place. And actually, we did really well. People really responded well to our comic books. We had our small booth in the middle of, like, nowhere, but people found us and talked to us, and it was really wonderful.
So how did you start out making your comics? Well, you said you write the stories, so did you just decide to write the stories one day and then said, hey, this will make a great comic, or you knew ahead of time you were going to turn this into a comic?
Well, I'm a big reader of prose, so I always kind of thought I was going to be a novel writer, and I still kind of hope that will happen. And but in college, I discovered, actually very late, in college, I discovered comics. I read Neil Gaiman's Sandman, and I read Jeff Smith's Bone. And I just suddenly realized that, like, comics are amazing, and working with an artist could be really fun. So I did a small story called To Stop Dreaming of Goddesses for a Siren anthology, for an anthology called Siren. And that came out in 2009, and after that I decided, I'm going to write comic books. That was how I got into it.
So now you have, when I met you, you had three different books, a series of books out there. What order were they created in?
So my very first story was Recipes for the Dead, but that didn't come out until after I wrote To Stop Dreaming of Goddesses, I mean to put an anthology one day, because I sold out and I haven't reprinted it since. But Recipes for the Dead was doing really well, so I continued with that, and we're finishing up issue 3. After that, I did Nanette of the Forgotten Spirits, which is a spirited horror story about a ghost who searches for her family during the festival of the Day of the Dead, this Mexican traditional festival. And my third book is a short story collection called Papa, and it's a three like story collection of like fantasy stories that are about doomed relationships between a father and his child.
Do you find that you naturally gravitated toward a certain niche as the story-wise goes? Because the three stories that you have, I read The Recipes for the Dead, is very fantasy-oriented. And The Day of the Dead is also very, you know, fantasy and family-oriented. Was that a conscious decision, or is it just that's how it just worked out?
It just sort of works out like that. I tend to really, like you say, I tend to gravitate towards dark and fantasy stuff, even in, like, the books I read, the movies I watch. Like, I'm a huge fan of Guillermo del Toro stuff, like Pan's Labyrinth, and I read a lot of, like, fantasy, like Ray Bradbury. I guess that's more sci-fi, but when I started writing, it just started coming out in that kind of fantasy.
Now, with each book series that you have, there was more than one issue of each one. As today's day and age goes, the audience is more instant gratification. So I know that about five to ten years ago, the comic book, quote-unquote, comic book fans, which are more into the superhero stuff, mm-hmm. don't really buy single issues as opposed to just wait for the collected trades to come out. Do you find that to be true or false, since you were putting out issue and issue at a time?
Well, even if people did buy graphic novels, I would actually have a hard time funding a full graphic novel, so I'm sort of forced into issues. However, I haven't really found it much of a problem. Usually, people buy the first issue and then they come back for issue two and ask where's issue three. So I know there's interest, and I know I have gotten messages of people asking me, well, when are you going to finish this? And I do work on them as fast as I can. But I do find that no matter how long it takes me to finish an issue, the fans do stay and do wait. Maybe they're not thrilled about it, but they wait.
I mean, I actually am eagerly anticipating issue three, because I was like, oh, I like issue one, I like issue two, where's issue three? And I'm like, it's so weird to actually have to wait for something. You know, as days ago, you just get a whole trade paperback, just read the whole story beginning, middle, end. But it's kind of nice to have that desire to want to find out what happens next in the story. I remember in the old days, around the 90s, when Image Comics came out, and how they were consistently late with their books, and people waited, you know, years to find out what happens in a six-issue story. And there was some backlash on that. But I don't think that you have that as of yet, because the stories are interesting enough and they seem to be spaced out enough to keep the interest going, but not so much that they'll be attacking you wanting their product.
Yeah. I do space them out, and not completely on purpose. I work with artists that put in a lot of work, so it takes them longer time. So to battle that, that's why I do two issues at a time. So, I mean, two series at a time. So while one issue is being worked on for 4 to 6 months, the other one is coming out. So it's like, so then the wait becomes like 2 months instead of 6 months, or, you know, much longer. And then I put out my anthology while waiting for both my artists to finish school and get to their issues.
So how does that work, being an independent creator? And I do distinctly remember you mentioning to me when we met about how you had two separate artists on the Recipes series because of whatever reason that you had to work with two different people. Is that something that you like to do, trying to get as many different artists as possible, or you try to stay with the same art style on your series?
Well, when it comes to series, I do try to stay with the same artist if I can. With Recipes, we had some trouble with the first artist. I mean, she was amazing. She's a great human being, but she was young. I didn't realize when I first started working with her, because she was the first artist I've ever worked with. But it turned out that she was 19 years old, and she didn't tell me. So she was, like, going to college for her freshman year, and she told me she just couldn't do both things. And I understood.
You should have told her to quit college.
Right?
How dare she try and get an education? That's terrible.
and it's true. Who needs that? But she went to college, and I mean, we're still friends, and we still talk, and I tell her that once she finishes, she's invited to work on another series with me whenever she feels ready. And in the meantime, I discovered the work of Alison Schrum, and she did issue 2 and just finished issue 3, the drawings. So I kind of hope that she stays with me for a while.
Hassan, do you have any questions for Vera?
You basically found out you had a bug for it and decided to start putting out comics of your own. Where did you, where did you get the money to put these books out, to get artists to come together, not only the money, where did you find the money and the patience? Because sometimes dealing with other creative people can be not so much a wonderful experience.
That could be true. Well, the money question is a fairly easy one, and I got lucky that I got into comics pretty much as soon as Kickstarter became a thing. And I was one of the first few people who adapted to Kickstarter and began using it back in 2010. And we sort of grew together. And so I've created 7 separate projects on Kickstarter since it began.
Oh, excellent. That's fantastic.
And yeah, it was wonderful. It actually helped me get a bunch of my fans through that. And having people like my stuff helps me be patient with my artists when they're being a little slower than I would like. Sometimes my own family members just ask me, why can't you just tell her to be faster? And I'm like, they are being as fast as they can. They just are. The artists that I work with, I don't know if I'm just this lucky that they do beautiful work, but they also do it much slower than.
You know what? In general, all artists are kind of slow. You know, so yeah. It's not unique to you, but I mean, it's unique that you're able to kind of be zen about it. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool, you know. You're having success with it, so you're more appreciating the success that you're having, and using that as your fuel, as opposed to being enraged at the slowness of your potential creative people. So that's fantastic.
Thank you. Well, it's easier to be happy than it is to be angry.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, we need.
So what advice can you give to other people who are wanting to start their own comic book company right now, all people listening? Hey, I want to make my own comic book company. We always ask all the people on the show this question, so I was interested to see what the answer is. So what advice do you think can you give them to start their own book to make comics?
Well, my biggest piece of advice is to basically pick up a project that you want to do really, you're very passionate about it, and that you know that you're going to finish it. It is very hard to finish a project. Most artists, many people who are trying to be artists, just never get to finish, so they cannot become a professional. That is really the only, in my mind, is the only difference between a professional artist and one that hopes to be one, is just finishing a project. So my biggest advice is just choose something small in the beginning, and then just get more and more endurance. Finish something small and finish something bigger. And as your stuff grows on the internet, people will see that you're the kind of person that makes good work, that finishes their work, and they'll be interested in anything you do.
Wow. You'll find That's the best advice we've gotten.
Yeah, usually they say don't do it or join the military. We had one guy say. it's always refreshing. I think it's because you haven't been there for so long. You just started, quote unquote, started only 4 years ago. So I think you have more of a positive outlook, which is always nice.
it's very difficult, and a lot of times people get involved and they don't quite know what they're getting into,
Right.
And they have some kind of expectation of what the experience is going to be. I think she's saying that she's propelled by the you know, by enjoying the work and having, like, a positive reaction to her work. But, you know, a lot of times people get into it thinking they have this, like, one idea and it's going to make them, you know, someone's going to make a movie out of it. And when none of that happens, they get upset and decide that, you know, the entire, you know, exercise was a waste of time. Those are the ones those are the people we usually ask that question to, and they tell us it's better to join the military.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I think what you're saying is that you have to love it, and you have to be dedicated to it.
Yeah. You can't really go into it with big expectations. You sort of, you know, you hope for the best, but even if everything doesn't come out the way you love, at least you have a few years of enjoyment, maybe 10, whatever, however long you're in it, that you're loving it. As soon as you don't love it, then it's sort of time to leave.
That's fair enough. You know, do what you love, which is always a theme that we like to do. Even though we sometimes poke at it, doing what you love is very important, because this is a labor of love. It is not, you know, a big money maker, but you can make money off of it as a nice bonus, but it's always best to do what you love first.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about that. Look what happens when you go into it to make money.
Yeah.
You know, look what's happening to the retailers and these other people, you know, at the industry. The industry can't support rock stars. You know, it's a cottage industry. It really is. It just thinks it's a super multi-billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
And you know, but yeah, I'm off my soapbox. I swear.
So Vera, how do you go about finding artists? Because you said that you didn't even know this girl was 19. I'm guessing that meant you spoke to her on the internet only first.
Yeah, and then she lives in Taiwan, so I didn't know what she looked like for the first 3 years.
Taiwan, man.
Yeah. She knows almost all my artists are... none of them are in New York. Well, I had one artist that lived in Brooklyn, but she was a hermit, and I've never seen her anywhere either. I have no idea what she looks
so
like.
So she could also live in Taiwan.
She might as well have.
So where do you find your talent? How do you go about finding people? How does this work?
So it's a very long, weird process that I do. I basically scour, like, websites like DeviantArt and blogs and just see who's working. And I look at, like, hundreds of artists until I find somebody who I feel is, like, perfect for the book. And then I just cold call, ask them. I did not know any of the people I work with. I just email them out of the blue. I told them I will pay them money, and I showed them a script. And usually they got back to me, you know, with a positive response. So sometimes some people never got back to me, and some people would get back to me and say, no, thanks. Yes, and I got very lucky because I also searched through artists that are not very, like, known by, like, the art, by the comics medium. So because they're unknown, they're looking for interesting projects to get their feet into the door.
Right.
And as well as I am, so together we get to collaborate and do something together.
Even though I only picked up one of the three books, I did thumb through the other two, and the artwork is very unique and different, very eye-popping. Is that something that you have to go over and over with, like, okay, make it more pretty, make it more this, or is it just whatever art they normally do is what they show you?
Oh, I barely edit them. That's what they give me.
Wow.
I go through their portfolios, so I sort of know what I'm going to get before I get it. I'm actually in a kind of unique position when it comes to art, because even though I cannot draw, I actually was an art history major. And I looked at so much art for 4 years in college that I have a really good eye for if anatomy is right, if it's dynamic enough. And through, like, reading a lot of comics, I can tell if they know how to, like, do good storytelling through their layouts. And, like, I look through so many artists, and so I find somebody who can do all those things plus has the atmosphere for the comics that I'm, you know, working on. And then I just ask them and let them do what they want.
Wow, so it seems like a pretty good good relationship that you have going on here. It's very it's very refreshing once again to see how this transitions. Because, you know, we are used to a different type of work ethic, right, Hassan?
Yeah, well, by work ethic, do you mean, like, the ability to get work done, period, versus the inability to do any work?
Yeah, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, yeah, we're used to completely different kind of work.
So, Vera, we have about 5 minutes left, so any places you want to promote, any websites, any projects, and any other artists you want to promote, now's the time to do it. Go.
Okay, if you want to find me and all my books, we are greenteapublishing.com, just like it's spelled, green tea, like the tea, and publishing, like publishing.com. You'll find everything there. We do both digital and print. We send everything out. You can buy whatever you want. You could also find me on Kickstarter, 7 projects. They're all done, but you can still look at them. I think they're, you know, pretty fun to check out. I have 2 comics on Comixology right now, Papa and Nanette of the Forgotten Spirit, Part 1, and Part 2 will be coming soon. Also want to definitely promote my artist. Allison Strum is amazing. She is doing Recipes for the Dead with me. That's a Victorian punk, like, anti-romance adventure about a baker, like, who bakes her way into a demon's heart, basically. And Laura Mueller works with me on Annette of the Forgotten Spirits. And one of my favorite artists to work with is, his name is Ben Jelter. He worked with me on Papa. He also did the art of my very first comic, To Stop Dreaming of Goddesses. And I believe he is doing a webcomic for free right now, so it is always awesome to just Ben Jelter, J-E-L-T-E-R, Jelter. Yeah, that's all I have.
All right. You mentioned that you do print and digital comics. Do you find that because of the new media that digital is easier to do, or do you still find that good old-fashioned print is the way to go?
People who are first discovering my stories, and I think in general anyone's stories, I think they go for digital because they, you know, it's cheap and they don't know what they're getting. But I find that after people buy my digital stuff, they tend to come back and buy the print because they're so much prettier.
Yeah, I have to say the artwork was what drew me in, and then I remember walking by and I saw the artwork. You had that giant sign in the back, and I was like, "Well, what's going on over here?" And then you had an interesting pitch, which the art brought me in, but the idea was what kept me and got the sale. And if I don't know if you remember this, but as you were telling us about it, my little group, the guy standing next to us, who we didn't even know, was like, "I'll buy one too." And I've never had a side sale like that in my life, talking to an artist, and then somebody else comes along and wants to buy your stuff. So I think it was very good stuff you have out there.
And thank you for doing that. That was a really awesome moment. I was very happy.
So we have less than 3 minutes to go, so we're going to do some final thoughts. Vera, do you have any final thoughts for us?
Final thoughts? No, I don't know. I really hope you guys, I had a great time talking to you guys, and, you know, I hope you guys also continue doing your artwork. I know you guys are saying that you're having some trouble getting some work done. Just do something small and continue. Art is awesome, and it is work, but it shouldn't always feel like work. It should always be something you love, and just, like, if you're feeling like something big is too much and it's weighing on you, take a break from it and just do something fun and small.
That's pretty good final thoughts. Hassan, you have any final thoughts for us?
No. I think you definitely have to love it. You definitely have to stick with it. I'm very much looking forward to reading your books and seeing the work that you're talking about. And this is one of the first times I'm really excited about, like, picking up new stuff. So that's my final thought.
And so, once again, Vera, thank you very much. That's Vera Green Tea from Green Tea Publishing. See, I got it right this time. That about does it for this week on It Came From The Radio. Join us right here and every week on WGBB. If you miss any part of our show, you can go on to our website, www.itcamefromradio.com, and listen to the archives. Will be up in a week or so. Like us on our Facebook. Follow us on the Twitter, ICTFR, if I'm not mistaken. And you can always get that TuneIn app and hear us on your multimedia devices. We will see you next week.
You have been listening to It Came From The Radio with Mark Torres. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests did not necessarily reflect the views of WGBB, the owners, or staff. And now we return you to your earthly scheduled broadcast.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.